So probably the most important part of this class has to do with what we're going to be talking about next, which is energy and work and kinetic energy, all those sorts of things. And I'm pretty sure that energy is something you've talked about before in your biology and chemistry classes, where you've added up enthalpies or you've dealt with bond energies. All of those things have to do with the mechanical basis of energy. And what's going on is, I think, surprisingly simple and took surprisingly large time for people to figure out. It would be hard to name a person who is responsible for figuring out when conservation of energy occurred. It certainly wasn't Newton, and it probably occurred in the early half of the 1800s. The idea that something is held constant during all this motion is a little bit of a foreign idea. But we're going to be talking today about conservation laws. And what they mean is that some quantity is held constant. That is to say, is the same at the beginning as it is at the end. So in chemistry, you can have a chemical reaction, and the number of carbon atoms at the beginning is equal to the number of carbon atoms at the end. So that's conservation of the number of carbon atoms. Here we're going to be talking about conservation of energy as being a particularly important concept. But energy doesn't obviously seem to be conserved. That is to say, if you start something in motion, it goes for a while and then it stops, typically. So we can't have exact conservation of energy. We have forces that cause energy to be used up, or more appropriately, converted into heat. Because overall, energy is going to be conserved, as we'll learn in the last mod of this course. So the starting point, probably the most important theorem that we're going to have in this course, is called the work kinetic energy theorem. And neither of those are words we've used before, so we need to define them. So kinetic energy is simple. It's just 1/2 times the mass times the speed squared. And work is pretty simple. Approximately speaking, work is the force times the displacement. At least it is if things are only moving in one direction. If we have situations where we have vectors and things are moving in different directions, then the definition of work is going to be, so let's say we have the object that's moving there and under this force, then the work is going to be the magnitude of the force, the magnitude of the displacement, times the cosine of the angle between those two things. So in one dimension, the force is either in the same direction as the displacement, or the force is in the opposite direction of the displacement. Here we're going to get negative quantities for work, and here we're going to get positive quantities for work. Yep?
That's the force times the displacement of what's that second letter?
The object. I used a delta R there. So this is the displacement vector, the change in position in x, y, and z coordinates. Okay, so what the work kinetic energy theorem says is the net work, and what I mean by that is add up the work done by all the forces, this thing is going to equal the change in the kinetic energy. And what we mean by change in is the final minus the initial. So for lots of forces, the work done is we're going to have to use this sort of moderately complicated way of figuring them out, but for other forces it's pretty simple, at least a lot of the time. So if we think about normal forces, if I think about pushing this thing along, the normal force is perpendicular to the direction that it's going. So in this situation, the normal force isn't doing any work. The frictional force is doing work, right? It's fighting me, and I'm doing work. The frictional force is doing negative work, I'm doing positive work, but the normal force isn't doing any work. Now, I can't say that the normal force never does work. If you think about a box that's sitting in an elevator and the elevator goes up, then the normal force is in the same direction as the displacement, so the normal force would be doing work under those circumstances. But in lots of situations, the normal force isn't going to be doing any work. The frictional force is almost always doing negative work because it's usually in the opposite direction as the motion. For a variety of forces, we have simple formulas for the work. And in the cases where we have simple formulas for the work, we call those conservative forces. So for a conservative force, we can write the work as minus the change in some quantity, which I'm going to call the potential energy. So for example, gravity is a conservative force. And it turns out we can calculate the work as minus the change in the height times mg. So if we go from an initial height that's small to a final height that's big, the displacement is up, the force of gravity is down, so we're expecting to get negative work. And what we're going to get then is minus a small number. So we're in fact going to get a negative value for work under those circumstances. Okay, so we can say then that the potential energy of gravity is equal to mgh. And it turns out, so right now it looks pretty bad, right? So on our list of forces, the only one that we've talked about a potential energy for is gravity. But it turns out that most forces have corresponding potential energies. So usually, we can use an equation like this to calculate the work done by that force. And really, the main exception is friction. Friction is the one force that isn't conservative all the time. And so there, we can never write the work as a change in some potential energy. So you might wonder about why did we put this minus sign in here. And the answer is that we're really going to put it on the other side of the equation. So if I take the work done by the forces that aren't conservative, and I add the work done by the conservative forces, that has to give me the change in the kinetic energy. And I've just said that the conservative forces, I can write the work as minus the change in the potential energy. So that means I can say that the work done by the non-conservative forces is the change in the kinetic energy plus the change in the potential energy. And I can write that then as the change in the energy, where energy is going to be the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. So right now, potential energy seems, you know, not maybe all that useful a quantity because it just applies to gravity. But we can have chemical potential energy, we can have nuclear potential energy. Basically, everything except friction, there's a corresponding potential energy. So this division is actually something that occurs all the time. And although friction is commonplace for macroscopic objects, if we're talking about chemical reactions, individual molecules, there aren't non-conservative forces, in which case we have the change in the energy is zero, which means that the energy is held constant. So the energy is going to be constant if there are no non-conservative forces. So the difference is whether we can write the work in this simple formula. Okay. If you can write it like that, then it's conservative. If you can't, then it's non-conservative. Okay. It's kind of a tautology.
So there's a lot of different forces that fit under both categories?
So really, all of the big forces, the electric force, the magnetic force, the gravitational force, the nuclear force, all those long list of forces, all of those have corresponding potential energies. Really, the one that doesn't is friction. So right now it looks kind of bad because we only have one potential energy. But throughout this course, we'll be adding potential energies as we talk about more forces. So it's really friction is the exception as opposed to the rule. Particularly when we're talking about microscopic situations like chemistry.
So is friction the only non-conservative force, though, right?
Boy, only is a big word. So I'm not gonna cop to only. It's the only one I can think of right now.
Okay.
More questions?
So what does it mean to be conservative versus a non-conservative force? Like, what's the kind of definition of both?
There it is. If you're a conservative force, if you can write the work done as the change in potential energy. But let me expand on that a little bit, because that may seem like, well, you could pretty much always do that. Well, one of the things that means, if the work that's done just depends on the initial and the final state, then that means that the work that's done doesn't depend on how you got there. Right? So that no matter what path you take, connecting the initial state and the final state, it has to add up to the same amount of work if you could do that. And obviously that's not the case of friction, right? So the least amount of work is probably going to take you between those two points in the shortest possible distance. But if you go by way of Hawaii, there's going to be a lot more frictional force. Okay, so path independence has to go along with the idea of being a conservative force. But all of the biggies, any force that you're going to deal with in microscopic life, electromagnetic force, chemical forces, nuclear forces, the weak force, gravitation, all of those guys are conservative forces. Questions? Okay, so we got one important theorem, the work kinetic energy theorem, that says that the work done by all of the forces gives you the change in the kinetic energy. We have a version of that if we have non-conservative forces present, then the change in the energy is due to the non-conservative forces. So if something starts out with lots of energy and it slowly decays and dies out, that must mean that there are non-conservative forces, typically friction, that are present, that's causing that energy to be used up.
What does H stand for again? Is that just height of something?
Or? Yes, the height.
Okay, just
yep.
Sure.
Yep. So maybe Y would be better then.
Okay.
More questions? Well, let's take a look at how these things bear out in some of the problems. So here's kind of the lineup for problems to look at. And let's actually start with 18 as opposed to 15. So what we've got is a guy who is pushing this crate, and he encounters a rough spot where the coefficient of kinetic friction is given by that, and we're supposed to calculate all of this stuff. Okay, so the first part really doesn't have a lot to do with work and energy, and you'll see that a lot in these problems. They harken back to the previous chapter. We can kind of never forget those free body diagrams and those equations like x is equal to x sub ot plus 1/2 at squared. We're going to be using those things forever. And they often play a role in these sorts of questions, even though they're not directly related to the energy ideas. So the picture we've got is this crate. It has some mass, which is 92 kilograms. So it's got a weight. And there's a normal force that's present on it. And the guy's pushing it forward with some force. And we know that friction is fighting that force. We have a formula for kinetic friction as opposed to an inequality. The frictional force is the kinetic coefficient of friction times the normal force. If we look at the sum of the forces in the x direction, we have that the force minus the frictional force has to be the mass of the crate times its acceleration. In the y direction, there is no acceleration. So there we have the normal force minus mg has to be zero. So we learn from that that the normal force has to be just the weight, and we can plug that in there. So not particularly relevant to energy, the net force is the applied force minus the kinetic coefficient of friction times the weight. And we're told that the force is 275 newtons. And the kinetic coefficient of friction is 0.358. And mg is 92 times 9.8. So we can calculate this net force, if we really want to, on the crate. 275, and then we've got 0.358 and 92 and 9.8. No, doesn't ring a bell. Let's see what I got the first time. Yeah, I guess I got it right. So I've got a net force that is minus 47.7 newtons. Okay, so that's not so much important for the energy. What's the net work done on the crate? Well, we need to calculate the work done by the force F. And that's just going to be the force times the distance that it moved, right? And they tell us that that distance is 0.65 meters. The work done by friction, lowercase f, is negative because the force is in the opposite direction of the displacement. And we've got the kinetic coefficient of friction times mg times L. So the net work is just the sum of those two. Right? So the work due to F, yeah, we'll do it over here. Work due to F is the 275 newtons times the 0.65 meters. So that turns out to be 178.8 what? Well, in terms of units, what we've got are Newton meters. But just as before, we got tired of writing kilogram meter per second squared all the time. We named it for a famous dead physicist, Newton. We're going to do the same thing here. We're going to name a Newton meter to the famous dead physicist, Joule. One of the guys who played a role in conservation of energy. The work due to the frictional force, we've got the kinetic coefficient of friction times the weight times the displacement with a minus sign because the friction is in the opposite direction as the displacement. So we've got minus 0.358 times 92 times 9.8 times the distance, 0.65 meters. And I get minus 209.8. So the net work is, of course, just going to be the sum of those two. And it's going to be negative minus 31.05 joules. Question?
So now, how did you get F of, or, you know, like the work of force and the W of little f? How did you come up with those?
So our definition for motion in one dimension, which we have currently, the definition of the work is it's the force times the displacement. So here we have a force that's in the direction of the displacement, so we have a positive work. And here we have a force that is fighting that displacement, so we have a negative. If we had a more general situation, then we'd have the magnitude of the force times the magnitude of the displacement times the cosine of the angle between them. But here the cosine is either 0 or 180 degrees, so it's either plus or minus 1. Okay, so that's the work that's being done. The net work is negative, so that means the speed is going to decrease. And we can calculate that by using the work kinetic energy theorem. So the work kinetic energy theorem says that the net work is equal to the change in the kinetic energy. And that's, of course, the final kinetic energy minus the initial kinetic energy. So the problem is asking for the final velocity, and that will be given to us pretty much if we have the final kinetic energy. So if we rearrange this, we've got the final kinetic energy is equal to the initial kinetic energy plus the net work. So this is addition, but remember that this net work is actually negative, right? It's minus 31.05. In terms of the initial kinetic energy, we can calculate that. It's 1/2 the mass times the speed squared. The mass is 92. The initial speed is 0.85 meters a second. So our initial kinetic energy is 33.2. And let's take a second to look at our units. So we've got kilograms, and we've got meters per second squared. And if we steal one of those meters per second, what we've got is kilogram meters per second squared times meters. This is a newton. That's a meter. A newton meter is a joule. So it better have come up with units of joules. So initially we had 33 units, and we lose, because of the non-conservative force, 31 joules. And so the net kinetic energy afterwards is given by the sum, which looks like a difference of those two numbers. Well, we're not there yet, because it asks for the speed. But if the kinetic energy is a simple function of the speed, so we have then that 1/2 the mass times the speed squared has to be this 2.18 joules. So the speed has to be the square root of the 2.18 joules times 2 divided by the mass, 92. So if we crank that out, 2 times that number, 92 divided by its square root, what I get is 0.218. Let's check our units. So what we have here are joules divided by kilograms. And a joule, we learned here, was a kilogram meter squared per second squared. So the kilograms go away. And under the radical, we have meters squared per second squared. So we're going to get, in the end, what we better get, meters per second.
Is the 2.18 the final kinetic energy?
Yes. Kinetic energy is always 1/2 mv squared.
So what is the 33.2?
This one?
Yeah.
It had a different speed, so it had a different kinetic energy. right?
For the bottom, V equals square root of, is that 2.18 joules times 2?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. This 2 came up. More questions? So let's take a look at 15. 15 is a question we could have answered before without doing this in terms of work and energy. So let's maybe do it both ways. So the story is that we're shooting a gun at a board. And initially, this bullet was moving at 575 meters per second. And it has a mass of 7.8 grams. And afterwards, it's going to be stuck at rest in the wood. And it's going to have penetrated 5.5 centimeters. And of course, the reason it slowed down is because of the huge frictional force that it encounters in trying to move through the wood. And we're supposed to calculate that frictional force. So if we think about this in terms of work and energy, we had lots of kinetic energy at the beginning. We have zero kinetic energy at the end. And what's happened is a non-conservative force has led to a change in the kinetic energy. And we know that the work done is equal to the change in the kinetic energy, which is the final kinetic energy, which is zero in this case, minus the initial kinetic energy, which we can calculate from 1/2 mv squared of the bullet. The work done is by this frictional force. And you can see that the frictional force is in the opposite direction of the displacement. So the work is going to be minus the frictional force times the distance that the bullet has penetrated. So now we pretty much know everything, right? We know the distance it's penetrated is 5.5 centimeters. The initial kinetic energy we can calculate from 1/2 mv squared. And the only thing we won't know is the force. Notice that the minus signs will take care of themselves. So we've got a pretty simple formula for the force. The force is going to be the initial kinetic energy divided by the displacement. Okay, so the kinetic energy is 1/2 the mass. Remember that we want to get into kilograms. They gave it to us in grams. So this is 7.8 times 10 to the minus 3 kilograms. And 575 meters per second squared. And the displacement is 5 centimeters, which looks like that after you've converted it to meters. So we've got 575 squared and 7.8 inner exponent minus 3. And we're dividing that all by 2. And we're dividing it by 0.055. And what I get is 2.34 times 10 to the fourth.
See, on the top of that fraction, it's 7.8x. Is that a CO to the negative term?
10.
10. Oh, so 2.8 times 10 to the, oh, okay.
Because we're converting from grams to kilograms.
Let's see what it is. Okay.
Let's check our units. Better be newtons, because that's what forces are measured in. So we've got kilograms, meters per second squared, and meters. So we've got kilograms, meters per second squared, and meters in the denominator. So we've got a kilogram, only 1 meter left per second, and that's a newton. Okay, so I claim that we could have actually worked this problem without talking about work and energy if we really wanted to. And that's because in this problem, the only force present is the frictional force. And we know that the net force is equal to the mass times the acceleration. So if we could figure out the acceleration, we'd be all set to calculate the frictional force. And we've got an equation for acceleration that just involves the things that we know, right? So you remember that the initial velocity squared plus 2 times the acceleration times delta x is equal to the final velocity squared, right? So the final velocity is 0. The initial velocity is this 575. The delta x is this 0.055 meters. And we're going to get a negative acceleration, of course, big D acceleration, that's producing this force that's in the negative x direction. Okay, so we don't have to, well, we are instructed to use work and energy in order to solve the problem. So the next problem asks us to calculate times, and we could do that the same way we've been doing it, right? We've got any number of ways of doing it. For example, we've got the fact that the average velocity could be calculated either by the change in position over time or by just literally averaging the velocities. Right? So we know the initial velocity, final velocity is 0. This is the 5 centimeters. But that's really just back to chapter 2 sorts of questions. Ski jumper problem. So in the ski jumper problem, we've got ski jump looks kind of like that. Here's the ground. The initial height of the ski jumper is 50 meters. And here at the end, it's 10 meters. And it's a really good ski jump. It's frictionless. So that means that there's not going to be any work done by friction. And we're supposed to figure out what the speed is of the ski jumper just when he leaves the bottom of the jump. So the forces that are present are just the normal force and the force of gravity. The normal force isn't doing any work, right? Because the normal force is perpendicular to the displacement. So the only force that's doing work is the force of gravity, and we have a formula for the work that's done by gravity. It's minus the change in the potential energy. So the work done by gravity, it's minus the change in the potential energy of gravity. That has to be the change in the kinetic energy of the skier, which is, of course, the final kinetic energy minus the initial kinetic energy. And the guy started from rest, so the initial kinetic energy is 0. The formula we've got for potential energy is mgh. So what we've got here is minus mg, the final height, minus mg, the initial height. That all has to equal the final kinetic energy. And I don't like minus signs if I can avoid them. So let's factor out that g and push the minus sign through. So we're going to get mg times the initial height minus the final height is equal to the final kinetic energy. But it didn't ask us for the final kinetic energy. It asked for the final velocity. But if you know one, you know the other, because the kinetic energy is just 1/2 mv squared. And it's good that they asked it that way, because they didn't tell us the mass of this guy. And you can see that the mass cancels out. Any skier is going to have the same mass. It's going to have the same final velocity. So we've got then that the velocity squared is 2 times g times how far he fell. So if we plug and chug, the velocity is going to be the square root of 2 times 9.8 times the 40 meters that he fell in going between 50 and 10. And I get pretty much dead on 28. Check units. We've got meters per second squared for g, and we've got meters there. So we've got meters squared per second squared under the radical. So we are getting units that we expect. So there's another way of working the problem, which is, I think, probably the way I would work it from the start. And that is realizing that there's no friction present. We know that the change in energy is zero. So I can set the initial energy equal to the final energy. The final energy is going to be made up out of kinetic energy and potential energy. Same thing with the initial energy. It's going to be made up out of initial kinetic energy, which is actually going to be zero, plus initial potential energy. So if I bring that potential energy to this side of the equation, I have mg initial height minus final height is 1/2 m times the final velocity squared. The masses cancel out, and I'm at exactly the same spot I would be. So pays your money, takes your choice. You can set the works equal to the change in kinetic energy and realize that there are simple formulas for work. Or in the absence of friction, you can say the initial energy equals the final energy and kind of go from there. So the book kind of loves to combine old chapters. For part B, it says, well, we now know that this guy is going 28 meters per second at an angle of 45 degrees, and now we're back at a projectile problem, right? I'm not going to work that part. Let's take a look at 85. So for 85, we've got a truck that's going uphill, constant 7-degree slope. And the package is going to stay on the floor of his truck. And we're supposed to figure out the network done and lots of other things. So some of these are easier to solve than others. So what's the network done on the package? Nope. Zero. Because there's no change in kinetic energy. Right? It says that it's going at a constant velocity. So we don't have to do any work, no pun intended, in order to answer part A. How about part C? What's the work done by the normal force? So the normal, the word normal means perpendicular, right? So the normal force is perpendicular, the displacement is that way. So the work done by the normal force is cosine of 90 degrees, which is zero. So it's not 7 degrees, it's perpendicular, right? The surface is tilted at 7 degrees, and the normal force will be 90 degrees from that. It's perpendicular to whatever surface it's sitting on. So the net work is zero, and the work that the normal force is doing, which is very commonly zero, is zero. So there are only two other forces that are present, the force of gravity and the force of friction. So they have to add up to zero. The work done by gravity is going to be negative, right? Because it's going up and gravity is pulling it down. The frictional force in this case is what's pushing it up. So usually we think about frictional force as having negative contributions, but here it's going to have a positive contribution. So if I could calculate either one of those, I could get the other one immediately. And the work done by gravity is easy, right? It's just mgh, change in mgh. So we've got some geometry to work on. We've got a slope that is 7 degrees and 340 meters long. All we need to figure out is the height change, because the work done by gravity is minus the change in the potential energy, and the formula for potential energy is just mgh. So what we've got is minus mgh final minus mgh initial. Or if you want, I'll leave that minus sign out front, because I know that the answer I'm expecting to get is negative. So this distance, that's exactly the difference in heights. Yes? Yes, okay. Not looking happy. And this thing here I could calculate, of course, because it's a side opposite this 7 degrees. So this is going to be the 340 meters times the sine of 7 degrees. So the work done by gravity is going to be minus the mass of the crate, which is 50 kilograms, g, which is 9.8, and this height difference, which we've just said is 340 meters times the sine of 7 degrees. And once we've gotten the work done by gravity, all we have to do is get rid of the minus sign to calculate the work done by the frictional force in pushing the thing uphill. And I get minus 2.03 times 10 to the fourth. Check our units. We've got kilograms from the 50. We've got meters per second squared from g. And we've got meters from that 340. And those are the units of joules. So the work done by friction is just plus 203 times 10 to the fourth, because we know they have to add up to zero. Okay, so this is kind of a funny problem. Funny because, well, I don't know, typically people try and order their problems so that the simple stuff comes first and the harder stuff comes later. And because the hard stuff really doesn't even have anything to do with this chapter. It has to do with the previous chapter. So we've got this situation where somebody's pushing this brick up the wall, and they're going to ask us for the work done by all of the forces. So what's the work done by the normal force?
Whatever you're pushing it up against the wall with.
Yeah, you're kind of pushing it, so you can see which way your force is.
Oh.
You're both pushing it and compressing it.
It'd be the force times the sine of theta, or whatever that is.
Mass gravity sine theta.
Any answers that don't involve calculations? I like zero. Because the normal force is normal to the surface, and the displacement is up the wall.
But you're pushing it at an angle, so aren't you pushing it against the wall?
I am. So F is going to be doing some work, but the normal force, which is this force, is doing zero work.
Oh, work. I'm sorry.
How much work is the force of gravity doing? So the force of gravity is down, right? It's mg. Louder? No one's fessing up to it, huh? So it's going to be negative, first of all, right? Because the force is in the opposite direction of the displacement. So we could calculate it by just the formula that the work is the force times the displacement. So minus, because they're in opposite directions, mg times the 3 meters that it's going up. Or the work done by gravity is minus the change in the potential energy. So we have minus mgh final minus mgh initial. So that's going to give us minus mg times the distance that it's moved up, which is 3 meters. So either way, it's minus mg times 3.
What's that for the delta sign on the top there, the F delta?
That's, you can change, I wrote an X, but you might want it to be a Y because it's going in that direction. It's the displacement. Yes?
So what's the difference between the top that force, the displacement one, and the potential energy one? Like, how do you know which one to use at what time?
So first of all, if all is right with the world, they have to give the same answer, so it shouldn't matter. So the answer is you use the simplest one. And I think usually, but not always, usually the simplest one is the change in potential energy, minus the change in potential energy. More questions? Well, the gravitational change in potential energy is also just mgh, so we've got that one. So without a lot of work, we've got B, C, and D. In some sense, F is moderately simple. Well, I don't know, maybe in no sense is it moderately simple. So I'll redraw my free body diagrams. Here's my block. Here's the normal force. Here's the weight. There's some frictional force that is fighting motion, so it's going to be pointing down. And we have our pushing force that is at some angle, theta. And I don't know, you kind of pays your money and takes your choice. The formula we have for things that are at an angle is its force times the displacement times the cosine of the angle between those two. Right, so this is the force vector. That's the direction it's going. So the angle they've given us isn't the angle that I want. Well, but no big deal. I could subtract it from 90 degrees and I could be done. Another way of thinking, and that's fine. Another way of thinking about it, which is, I think, worth commenting on, is think about breaking the force up into pieces. Right, so we can think about this force as being exactly the sum of those two pieces. This piece, of course, does no work because the displacement is perpendicular to it. This piece is going to do 100% of work because it's exactly aligned with the displacement. So thinking about it that way, this piece of the force is, of course, F times the sine of theta. And so the work that it's going to do is F sine theta times the 3 meters, let me call it L, that it goes up. And it's, of course, a positive work. Well, okay. Unfortunately, that's not the end of it, because we don't know what F is. So, and actually, in order to calculate part A, we're going to have to do a fair amount of work in order to, that's basically chapter 4 type work, in order to figure out what that force is. So I don't know, grin and bear it. This is our free body diagram. The first step that we have to do is to set up a coordinate system once we've drawn the arrows. And 1, 2, 3 things are square with the usual coordinate system. So we might as well choose the usual coordinate system, normal XY coordinates. And then what we do is set the sum of the forces equal to the mass times the acceleration. And in this particular problem, they've told us what the acceleration is in the usual tricky fashion. Right? They've told us that it's moving at a constant speed, which is the way of saying that the acceleration is zero. So some of the forces then are going to have to equal zero in the x direction and in the y direction. So if we deal with the x direction first, we have this piece of the force that's in the positive x direction. That's F cosine theta. We have the normal force that's in the minus x direction, and they have to add up to zero. In the y direction, we've got this piece of a force that's in the positive y direction, but it's fighting gravity and the frictional force. This thing is actually moving, so we have an equation for the frictional force. The frictional force is the kinetic coefficient of friction times the normal force. And from this equation, we know that the normal force is equal to F times the cosine of theta. Seems like a lot of work just to get this force. So if I rewrite what I've got F times the sine of theta minus the weight minus the frictional force, which is the kinetic coefficient of friction times F times the cosine of theta. It all has to add up to zero. And I'm after F, so I want to isolate these guys. So let me put the minus mg to the other side of the equation and put the Fs together. So I get F times sine of theta minus mu k times cosine theta. That all has to equal mg. So the force has to be the weight divided by the sine of the angle minus the kinetic coefficient of friction times the cosine of the angle. So they tell us that the mass is 5 kilograms, g is always 9.8, and the angle is 30 degrees, and the coefficient of friction is 0.3. So we can crank that guy through. So we got 5 and 9.8. And I get 204 in terms of units. Nothing has units on the bottom, right? Coefficient of friction is unitless. So we just have m times g, and that gives us newtons. And once we've got that force, we can plug it into this this equation where? Yeah, this equation here to get the work done by that force. But boy, it seems like an odd thing to put first in the list of things that you need to do, since every other part is way simpler than that first part. Okay, questions. So lots of stuff today. Kinetic energy is mv squared. The work kinetic energy theorem, definition of work, two different ways of calculating for conservative forces minus the change in the potential energy, otherwise force times distance times the cosine of the angle between them. Lots of new types of problems we can work with conservation of energy. Any questions? So let's do some iQuiz problems. So we've got four pucks, and they have masses of 1, 2, 3, 4, and various forces are applied to these pucks, and they have various finish lines. And the question is, which puck has the largest kinetic energy when it crosses the finishing line, the finish line, its finish line? So it's pretty much like the last class. Kind of an equal mix, maybe majority C, I think. And majority is wrong in this circumstance. So the masses are going to be irrelevant because we can calculate the kinetic energy by the work that's done. And work is just force times distance. All of these things are in the same direction. So the biggest force and the biggest distance all occur with D. So it has to be the most kinetic energy. It weighs a lot, so it's not going to be going super fast, but it's going to have most of the kinetic energy. So let's kind of explore that a little bit more. So now we've reduced the race just down to two pucks. A is made of lead and B is made of rubber, subjected to the same force. Who wins the race? So it might be majority A's, or at least about a 50-50 mix. Yeah, which I don't buy. So A is made of lead. It weighs a lot more, right? So if you push it with the same force, it's not going to go very fast. It's going to have a much smaller acceleration. So the rubber puck is the one that's going to win, because it's going to be have a much larger acceleration. Force divided by mass gives us the acceleration. Which force does more work, right? So for B, it's all going to be over in a flash. For A, that force is going to be present for a longer time. Which one is going to do the most work? Ah, there's one right answer. If you're holding it in one hand, it's probably a wrong answer. So work is force times distance, right? Same force, same distance, same work. Exactly the same. So the force is going to be applied to A for a longer period of time, but the same amount of work is going to be done. Which puck has more kinetic energy when it crosses the finishing line? I see some two-handed people who have the right answer. It's the same, right? The work gives you the change in kinetic energy. They started from rest, same force, same distance, same change in kinetic energy, same final kinetic energy. So exactly the same for these two pucks. So puck A isn't going to be moving very fast, but it's got a lot of mass. And remember, kinetic energy is mv squared. So the big mass is going to exactly make up for the slower velocity so that it has exactly the same kinetic energy as, you know, the rabbit B. Well, we haven't. Momentum is the topic of the next class, and it turns out that work, what's played an important role is force times distance, roughly speaking. What's going to play a big role for momentum is force times time. And you can see that A is going to have a much larger time applied to that force. So the force times time, which we're going to give the name impulse to, the impulse is going to be larger for A, and so the momentum is going to be larger for A. Well, I'm not sure I'm going to do this as an IQuiz question, but it's an important idea, and it's given the name turning point. And it deals with the cases where we have conservative forces. So it's great, for example, with atoms reacting and colliding, because all of the forces there are conservative. So under these circumstances, the energy is going to be the sum of the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, and it's going to be a constant. And you might think, for example, about the potential energy being a function of the reaction coordinate in some sort of situation. If we have a certain amount of kinetic energy, so say here at 130, we have 5 units of kinetic energy, that means we're always going to have a total amount of energy that's going to put us on the 10 mark, right? We have 5 units of potential energy and 5 units of kinetic energy. The total amount of energy is always going to be 10. So what happens as these atoms start to collide, here we have less potential energy, so that means we have to have lots of kinetic energy, so the particle is going to be moving fast at this point. It's going to be slowing down as the potential energy rises to meet the energy, and at this point it can't have any kinetic energy anymore. It has to be stopped, and it's going to reverse and go back out the other way. So what we do on these sorts of graphs is we plot the potential energy versus, so this is the potential energy versus position, and if we know what the total energy is, we can see what the kinetic energy is. The kinetic energy has to be the difference between the potential energy and the known energy. So in this circumstance, this particle has to be bouncing back and forth between these two spots where it has to be at rest. So spots where the total energy equals the potential energy and hence the kinetic energy is zero, those are called turning points. So in this circumstance, if the particle had an energy that was 25, total energy that was 25, it would have lots of kinetic energy at this point, even more kinetic energy. It would slow here, but it wouldn't stop. It'd pick up speed again, but it would turn around at about there, where again the kinetic energy would be zero. In order to get past this barrier, we would have to have a total energy that is more than 30. And then we could zip through all the way to the origin. Okay, so more on energy next time. So there, if you go to WebAssign, there is homework assigned for today's class, and I'll put the next big block of it online, but I haven't done that yet.
Okay.
But the WebAssign for next time is there.
Okay. So for next time.
No, for this, the one that you want to turn in by midnight Monday is there.
Yes. We don't have to do today.
Right. Yep.
Calculate my exam score.
Okay, so this is your exam score right there, 44.
Okay.
Your overall grade, if you wanted to calculate it, would be a combination of the homework grade and your exam score.
Okay, so this is the homework grade.
Mm-hmm. So currently, in the end, they're going to weight equally. The homework is going to count the same as an exam.
Mm-hmm.
So here you're going to have 119 plus 6, which is 125, divided by 143 times 100 to make it into a percent.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an 87. So if I average the 87 and that score,
mm-hmm.
so I add them up and divide by the only two scores that we've got, that's what you've got, which is mm-hmm. currently, if we look on the sheet, anything that's above a 64 is a C, so that would currently be a C.
Okay.
But it's not good, right?
No.
So everything is fine if the rest of the exams don't look like that one.